Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. This time on today's show, we'll hear from food service businesses about how they've adapted to a new normal during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I had only been open for a little more than 4 months, and to have to shut the doors was pretty devastating.
RVs and trailers are having a moment right now, with Americans looking for a way to vacation without sacrificing their safety.
Only when we started looking did we realize we were part of what I'll call the pandemic demographic of trailer buyers.
Also, a new coal mine is coming to the Powder River Basin, and an update on Laramie's Pilot Hill. Those and more right here on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. Wyoming has approved its first coal mine permit in decades. The Kentucky-based coal company Ramaco now has the go-ahead to start mining near Sheridan in northeastern Wyoming. The process to get to this point was anything but simple. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Anton Bosick lives on an 80-acre ranch where he deals in hay and cattle. His family's lived there for 42 years. It's the closest property to Ramaco's newly approved Brook Mine.
I'm 0.17 miles from the proposed mine.
Since 2017, Bosick has been stressed out about how a mine might affect his water well, how blasting would affect the community's recreation, or how the nearby road would get busy with haul trucks. It turned out there were several nearby landowners who had similar concerns back then, too. So they connected with a landowner group based in Sheridan called the Powder River Basin Resource Council. Since then, Bosick and his sister Joan Tellez have become players in a contentious battle over the first coal mine permit in decades.
Because we've written letters, we've had meetings, we've tried to meet with DEQ.
And now, 3 years since the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality deemed the permit technically complete, it's approved it and put an end to this lengthy chapter. For Randy Atkins, the CEO and chairman of Ramaco Carbon, he's very relieved to have come out on the other side after so much debate.
Delighted it happened. I wish it had happened a little sooner. I mean, it was really more of a theater that I think was put on by, the Powder River Basin folks to try and delay the process. And so it did indeed delay the process. But, fortunately, we kept our guns and we are where we are right now.
The story begins back in 2014, when Ramaco first submitted its permit application to develop the Brook Mine. The plan was lauded by Governor Matt Mead, with a plan to mine 100 million tons of coal over 20 years and bring in 600 new jobs. Later on, the company clarified that it would be a much smaller operation, with a focus on finding new uses for coal. Ramaco now plans to use the resource for value-added products instead of burning it. The Brook Mine also now considers about 30 to 40 direct mining jobs. Back in 2017, the Sheridan mayor applauded the efforts. Also back then, Atkins explained how it could work.
So if only 14% of the weight of U.S. autos, and that's body and parts, were derived from carbon fiber made from coal, that would be over 100 million tons of coal translated into making that carbon fiber.
Today, Atkins is excited about the idea of turning the Powder River Basin into a hub for carbon entrepreneurship. Bosick and other landowners got involved soon after the DEQ deemed the permit technically complete. Many were frustrated that there was no public meeting. Here's homeowner Brooke Collins from back then.
Where is the permit? Where are the people that promised to come talk to us? What's going on with this?
The company, though, felt they had done their due diligence and had the sign-off. Then landowners dug deeper. They hired outside scientific experts and found deficiencies in the permit. Surface owner Bighorn Coal also participated with its own questions. Anton Bosick, for one, was happy to get involved.
You know, we're just a small family, and, we can't afford a lawyer. So we went with Powder River to have somebody speak for us and do some research.
Landowners in the PRBRC pushed for a contested case hearing in front of the Independent Review Board, the Environmental Quality Council. The DEQ pointed to that as the public hearing demanded by landowners.
From the data provided,
Ramaco argued DEQ had been okay with its permit application. The other side pointed towards the need for more research into subsidence and hydrology. In the end, the EQC voted in favor of rejecting the permit and requested many of those revisions.
Thank you all for your patience. This hearing is recessed.
Ramaco later won a court battle, though that's under appeal, questioning whether that decision from the EQC was valid. The debate flared up again this May during an informal public hearing, as Ramaco returned with a revised permit based on EQC recommendations. By then, about 100 individuals and businesses sent comments to the DEQ regarding the project, many of them in favor as well as opposed. The PRBRC had experts in hydrology and subsidence comment once again. Ramaco's lawyer, Tom Sansonetti, voiced frustration at how lengthy and arduous this process has been.
And this permit is being held to the highest standards. Those who would say otherwise have different agendas regarding the issuance of this permit, or indeed any extractive industry permit.
Since then, the DEQ has decided to grant the permit, but with conditions. DEQ Deputy Director Alan Edwards explains.
Some of those were a direct result of information we received during the public comment period and the informal conference.
Finding that, yes, DEQ does need to see more data on subsidence before certain mining can occur. That blasting couldn't happen on weekends or holidays. That the Brook Mine would need to limit ground vibrations to protect structures near the permit area. Randy Atkins said he's obviously happy to have the permit, but that it was really in place years ago.
The refinements, you know, we could have easily dealt with in a simple, you know, agreement with the DEQ 2.5-3 years ago. So I think, you know, the passage of time and the additional rumblings and court cases and hearings, et cetera, truly didn't add much.
For Anton Bosick and John Telez, that's true. They would have liked to see much more come from the process. They're happy to see those additions, but are still worried.
I think there are probably a couple, but, you know, it's not anything that's real significant, I don't feel. Especially, like I said, they don't address the issues that we have.
She's especially worried about the traffic plan and transparency from the company. But from the point of view of the DEQ and spokesman Keith Giel, this process was successful.
We do consider their comments, and we did, at the end of the day, consider some comments to put in as additional conditions in the permit. And those comments really did help us move forward here.
The fight, though, may not be over quite yet. The PRBRC are still deliberating next steps, but have the option to file an administrative appeal with the Environmental Quality Council. But now, 6 years since the first permit application, the Brook Mine is a go. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Now, we turn to the issue of police reform. Thousands have taken to the streets across the country, and right here in Wyoming, calling for an end to unchecked police misconduct. An investigation by Wyoming Public Radio and the Casper Star Tribune found that in Wyoming, law enforcement accountability can be a long, uncharted, and demanding process. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao spoke with reporters Tennessee Watson and Shane Sanderson about what they found.
Let's start with the big takeaway from your reporting. Law enforcement accountability is complicated. Why is that?
So one thing I think is that there might be a false perception that there's some sort of uniformity to law enforcement across the country, maybe because they all wear similar uniforms and they drive similar cars. But in reality, law enforcement is hyper-local, and the sheriff is an elected official, for example, or in the case of a police chief, that person is appointed, but they're appointed by elected officials. And so there are variations from agency to agency, and that is one reason that holding law enforcement accountable is complicated, is because it differs from place to place, and their receptiveness to feedback, how they handle grievances, that is going to differ from agency to agency.
So how would you sum up the impact of that convoluted process for victims of police misconduct, but also just more generally for Wyoming?
Well, I think the first impact is that it's just the process of reforming behaviors and addressing police misconduct. It can be really slow. So that, you know, that means that if there are issues that need to be addressed, the onus is often on those who have suffered from those issues to come forward and share their experience. And then, you know, if litigation ends up being what happens, I mean, a lawsuit can take years. So the process of change is slow, and that means that misconduct can continue.
Yeah, and kind of another portion of that we run into is talked to a lawyer down in Denver who basically only does civil rights stuff, and he told us that he thinks it's not uncommon for lawsuits on the issue to be dismissed by some of these procedural hurdles that show up in the litigation portion. And he told me that it's concerning, I think, to him that, you know, there are legitimate complaints that wind up, well, just going away because of these procedural hurdles, or because the person filing the complaint isn't familiar. The data analysis we did on this, I think we came up with, for people who didn't retain their own lawyer, only 4% of them were received any kind of remedy after filing a civil rights complaint in federal court in the state of Wyoming. And I think that speaks to yet another barrier in kind of how many challenges there are once you decide you want to do something.
Right. So your reporting follows a sexual assault victim who filed a civil case against the Albany County Sheriff's Office. What drew you to this particular case?
So Tennessee pitched this piece to me, and I think when she pitched it, I was really intrigued by this fact that there's just not like a simple, easy path. You know, there's not an answer in a box. You know, I cover the courts in Wyoming, and I'm familiar with these type of lawsuits, and I cover the police departments, and I'm familiar with police misconduct. And you know, when she pitched this to me, I was like, man, if I was in somebody's shoes and I thought I'd had my civil rights violated by a law enforcement officer, like, I'm not sure I would know what to do. Which is pretty astounding, because I feel like I'm pretty close to these institutions and pretty familiar with them. And that's one of the things that's been interesting about this case, and hopefully important or helpful about this story, is that it at least gets us an idea of what remedies are available to people.
You know, I think there's been media attention because of civil rights violations or misconduct that's been caught on video because that thing happened in public. And with this particular case and the individual whose story we follow, the alleged misconduct, the alleged civil rights violations, they happened in, you know, an office inside of the sheriff's office. And so that's one of those things that not a lot of people would have known about if it wasn't for this individual coming forward. And so I think that's one of the reasons that I was drawn to report on this, because it really makes the point that the onus is on the individuals who are experiencing these things to come forward and sort of shine the light of day on what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now I'm curious, how else did you investigate law enforcement accountability?
One of the refrains that people say is, you know, if you don't like the sheriff's policy or the culture of that office, then elect a new one. It turns out that 68% of races in the last four election cycles were uncontested, and incumbents are 34 times more likely to win a sheriff's race than a challenger. We also looked at the Wyoming Bill of Victims' Rights, and we found out that bill, while it, you know, suggests what an interaction between a victim and the criminal justice system should look like, there's actually no mechanism of accountability. And so given that, it really does put a lot of onus on a victim to come forward and to figure out how to hold the criminal justice system and law enforcement accountable for misconduct or abuse that occurs.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson and Casper Star Tribune reporter Shane Sanderson discussing a joint investigation of law enforcement accountability. Read more in this Sunday's Casper Star Tribune, and thanks for joining me, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Next, we'll hear how Wyoming's delegation is receiving a new infrastructure bill. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards. Congress is now in recess for 2 weeks, but before the House gaveled out, Democrats passed a $1.5 trillion infrastructure bill. That bill is dead on arrival if Wyoming Republicans get their way, as correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
After dropping more than $3 trillion and counting on the coronavirus pandemic in the spring, Republicans decided to hide the nation's credit card. But with the pandemic worsening, along with this recession, both parties are recognizing Congress has more work to do. President Trump has called for sweeping infrastructure legislation in the past, so Democrats tried to see if he meant it and passed their $1.5 trillion infrastructure bill earlier this month. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney and other GOP leaders helped convince all but three Republicans to oppose it.
You know, we're in a situation where we've had multiple issues come up over the course of the last 2 weeks in particular, whether you're talking about police reform, whether you're talking about health care, whether you're talking about infrastructure, where there could have been bipartisan agreement, and where we need bipartisan agreement, and where there are major parts of the issues that really we could come together on.
Cheney complains that around 40% of the package is Green New Deal spending. She's accusing Democrats of using what little time Congress has, focusing on issues aimed at November's election, not the American people.
And unfortunately, each time the Speaker picks sort of this partisan agenda that she knows isn't going to become law. So I think, you know, it's unfortunate because it's a real missed opportunity when we have real infrastructure needs. And you know, those are the kinds of things we ought to be doing instead of the Green New Deal agenda.
Close to $500 billion of the Democratic bill is aimed at reauthorizing the nation's surface transportation programs, everything from roads to bridges. The legislation also infuses tens of billions of dollars into urban priorities, like money for electrical car charging, while also putting more federal dollars into mass transit. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says her proposal will spark life into this ailing economy.
When we talk about building roads and highways and bridges and transit and rail and airports and ports and harbors, that is so important for because it's job creating in its essence, but it's also commerce promoting. So it grows the economy of our country.
Like Congresswoman Cheney, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell remains dubious, especially because he sees House Democrats as trying to sneak the Green New Deal past Republicans.
Number one, spend an insane amount of money. Number two, check every far-left ideological box. Number three, propose bad policies. And four, forget about making law from the very beginning so you can legislate in a world of pure fantasy. Pure fantasy. Well, check, 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 check.
House Transportation Committee Chair Peter DeFazio, a Democrat from Oregon, says their bill is vital because it would begin to address climate change.
This is the most transformative and consequential transportation infrastructure bill, bigger than my committee, in the history of the United States of America.
On the other side of the Capitol, Wyoming's John Barrasso chairs the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Last year, his committee unanimously passed legislation aimed at boosting American infrastructure, which has yet to be taken up by the full Senate. Unlike the Democrats' bill, his is focused more on traditional concrete and steel projects, not the modern transportation investments Democrats and environmentalists are calling for. Barrasso rejects Democrats' attempts to combat climate change and instead wants to unwind regulations to make it easier to greenlight big projects.
Part of what has passed the committee that I chair in the Senate, the Environment and Public Works Committee, actually helps us get projects done faster, better, cheaper, smarter. That's what people in Wyoming are looking for.
Barrasso says he's still got the president's ear on his proposal.
There are things that we need to do from an infrastructure standpoint. I talk to the president about that regularly.
And Congresswoman Cheney, a Republican leader in charge of the party's messaging, dismisses Democrats' bill as all politics.
If you know the legislation is not going to become law, and you go ahead and you put it on the floor when you could have a bipartisan agreement, then there's no other interpretation except it's political. And it's really too bad because it hurts the country.
With party leaders like Cheney and Barrasso brushing aside House Democrats' transportation bill, many political watchers are wondering whether this divided Congress can overcome bipartisan disagreements during an election year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
COVID-19 pandemic has forced the nation to figure out something it's tried to do for years, increase access to telehealth. But as emergency orders end, will that access remain? The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports.
In a nutshell, telehealth is healthcare over video or phone. It's been tough to get it out to the masses, but then the pandemic hit.
We've done 10 years of telehealth adoption in 3 months.
That's Idaho Department of Health and Welfare Director Dave Jepson. He says during the pandemic, there's been a nearly 4,000% increase in Idaho's Medicaid telehealth claims.
March, April, and May of 2019, across all of Medicaid, we had about 3,000 telehealth visits that took place. And for that same time period here of 2020, we had 117,500 telehealth claims.
To allow that expansion, federal and state governments temporarily rolled back dozens of regulations. But now that so many people use telehealth, lawmakers don't want to go back to how it was before. In Idaho, Governor Brad Little recently signed an executive order that makes his state's telehealth changes permanent.
This step should help preserve these healthcare advances long after COVID-19.
That means Idahoans will be able to keep using phones and non-HIPAA-compliant platforms like Zoom to talk with healthcare professionals. Congressmen on both sides of the aisle want to maintain telehealth access, too. Tennessee Republican Senator Lamar Alexander championed this transition during a recent Senate committee hearing on the issue.
My recommendation is that of the 31 federal policy changes that we've had, which have helped cause this explosion of telehealth, that at least two be made permanent.
Those changes include both Medicare and Medicaid covering more telehealth services and covering people in more areas. Before, only people in specific rural locations could get telehealth covered, and even then, only certain types of treatment. Now, telehealth helps patients covered by those federal programs across the nation with everything from physical therapy to counseling. But private insurance companies have to be on board, too.
Telehealth has always been a unique challenge for the provision of healthcare.
That's John Worley with Blue Cross of Idaho. Historically, private insurance companies haven't reimbursed for a range of telehealth services that studies have shown can be safely provided over video or phone.
It provides great options and great opportunities for people, but it also raises a number of questions about quality of care, about access, about connectivity.
Still, the company committed to covering more telehealth appointments to keep patients safe during the pandemic. Companies across the country, including in our region, did the same. But end dates for their emergency measures are coming up. Blue Cross of Idaho, though, has decided to maintain its telehealth coverage until the end of the year and likely beyond.
I think as far as breadth of coverage, we will continue to provide these services into the future and provide access.
He says that's because they think it'll minimize costs, and they recognize that it's allowed more patient access to providers. Still, Worley says that doesn't mean Blue Cross will keep paying providers the same for video visits as for office visits.
We want to evaluate, look at the market, try and determine if people feel like they're getting the quality of care that they need, try and determine how many people are using it, and trying to determine what is an appropriate level of payment.
How much insurance companies reimburse for telehealth services, though, could determine whether providers can afford to offer them.
The private sector needs to step up as well.
Joseph Kavidar is president of the American Telemedicine Association and a professor at Harvard Medical School. He highlighted the need for maintaining the same level of reimbursements at the recent Senate committee hearing.
It would be very difficult to conduct this care model in a world where we got some payment for some things and didn't get paid for others.
All agree that physical offices and support staff will still need to be paid for, whether it's an in-person visit or a telehealth one. But even if all private insurers are on board and governments relax regulations, there are still many hurdles, broadband access being a big one, especially in rural counties across our region where the service is most needed. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
When we return, an update on Laramie's Pilot Hill project, right here on Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. Any way you look at it, bar and restaurant workers are on the front lines of the pandemic. Since Governor Mark Gordon eased restrictions, these businesses can now offer indoor service as long as staff is wearing face coverings. But some business owners aren't so sure they're comfortable with making decisions about how to keep the public safe. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao reports.
St. Patrick's Day is usually a popular day for bars to make money. And that's what Scott Lair, who owns The Great Untamed in Laramie, was expecting. But that was also around the time COVID-19 started hitting Wyoming.
Basically, the space of 1 week when things kind of started happening, and there was like nobody out downtown, which is very unusual for Laramie. And that whole week was pretty slow for me. And then I ended up decided to switch to takeout only. And then the next day I decided to switch to delivery and pick up stuff by appointment. So it all happened really fast.
1 week later, Governor Gordon issued a shutdown, and Lair had to make more changes.
It was a pretty difficult decision just because, you know, the bar, there's a really good community there, and, you know, making that switch means can't hang out at the bar together anymore. So that really sucked, but it became pretty clear that that was the safer decision to make.
Since then, Wyoming has gradually reopened, but Lair is still hesitant to do so.
The reason I haven't reopened is basically just because of the way my business is set up. I can continue doing the deliveries and pickups, or I can open up and do sit-down service. I can't do both.
Because the bar is really small and impossible to social distance. For Jill Hunter, owner of Molino Italian Bistro in Lander, reopening her restaurant was crucial to her employees and business.
I put so much money into this restaurant and building it and the startup costs with food and wine and everything. My whole thing was all I need to do is get to summer. I mean, we're in June and we're not even doing the numbers we were doing in January, February, which for Lander is off season.
She hadn't been open long when COVID-19 hit her community in Lander. So she decided to close her Italian restaurant because it would help flatten the curve.
And it was really hard because I had only been open for a little more than 4 months. And to get to that point of opening and how long it took me to get here and the struggles that it took to get here, and then to have to shut the doors was pretty devastating.
She had put her entire savings into creating the business, so she was determined to survive. She switched her services to takeouts, pickups, and deliveries only. But it wasn't the same because Molino's is meant to be a fine dining service. Takeouts and pickups just didn't do it justice.
So I was lucky enough that the governor came out and said that that's when we would be reopening at 50%. Because that was definitely when I was looking at my finances and I was looking at moving forward, I knew where I could get to financially before one of the things needed to happen, either open or close down.
According to the National Restaurant Association, Wyoming is home to over 1,300 eating and drinking locations, and its estimated sales is up to $1.1 billion. And that's why the Wyoming Business Council offered grants to help businesses stay afloat. Josh Durrell, the CEO of the Wyoming Business Council, prioritized communication with business owners first. He thought of how they might misunderstand information, and so they provided webinars to educate people. And the Business Council has helped with reopenings by doing a number of training and campaigns with businesses across the state and aiding the Paycheck Protection Program loans for business owners.
And just recently, our Main Street program launched the Shop Smart, Shop Safe campaign with local businesses on Main Streets to be able to really, you know, educate them, educate their customers, and really, again, work to help people feel more comfortable in those retail spaces.
It consists of mostly educational resources and assistance focusing on business recovery for local business owners. But their largest contribution is the business relief programs passed by a special session of the legislature to help the economy. The council, along with the legislature and governor, formed a plan to take $325 million from the CARES Act funding and used it to help the business community.
We are now in the middle of what we'll call Program One, which was intended to help those smallest businesses from 0 to 50 employees. It gives them the opportunity for up to a $50,000 grant, and that is a $50 million program. So the application process has been simple for businesses.
At the same time, the Business Council is also trying to observe safety precautions since COVID-19 is still out there.
Our goal is to help people with their livelihoods and make sure that their businesses are as resilient as possible. So I think that education leading up to this point has been good. Obviously, the funding that we're able to now provide to businesses throughout the state.
Durrell says he knows this won't fully revive businesses, but
to help them through that tough time and help them emerge on the other side is what we're really going for.
Businesses who are interested in applying for relief grants or want to learn more about the programs can visit the Business Council's website at wyomingbusiness.org. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Nina Rao.
The state's businesses are struggling right now, but in Laramie, there's one glimmer of hope. With its vast open spaces and nearly 98,000 square miles of public lands, outdoor recreation is a big deal in Wyoming. One group in Laramie plans to make that even larger, and their efforts are starting to come to fruition. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel has more.
The Pilot Hill Project started in 2017 when rancher Doug Samuelson approached Albany County with a proposition. They could have first dibs on his almost 5,500 acres of land just east of Laramie. It was already land people liked to recreate on in the past, but they had to raise the $10 million to purchase it within a year. Since then, it's blossomed into a community-wide project. And 3 years later, it's nearly ready to open to the public. I got a sneak peek at the property with Pilot Hill's Sarah Brown Matthews. The official closing date is expected to be in early August. Until then, it's still private property. The top half of the property is mostly wooded. As you move down the slope, it starts to become more open with exposed limestone areas that are important for refilling the Casper Aquifer.
And you can also see interesting geologic features, these uplifts over here of limestone. You can see this upper one has a neat cave in it, and one of our trails will allow you to get close to the cave.
The two-track we're on is an old ranch road. Most of the roads like this one will be converted into trails or allowed to weather away, but some will be maintained as easements and for emergency access.
There are some that are truly impassable. And there are some roads that are shown on maps that don't even exist.
The Pilot Hill property will eventually be crisscrossed by nearly 44 miles of multi-use trails for non-motorized recreation, built in three phases. The northern half of the property, where the bulk of the trails will support a wide variety of user groups, including mountain bikers, hikers, and horseback riders. Diane Kempson owns Nightingale Stables in Laramie.
We get people who are interested in coming here, and they'll say, is there trail riding around where you are? Well, no, we don't really have anything that people can directly access without getting in their horse trailers and going up to the Happy Jack area or going out to the Snowies.
Kempson says she wouldn't be surprised if the proximity to trails encouraged some overnight guests to stay longer, and that could help Laramie's economy. Outdoor recreation is one of the largest industries in Wyoming, accounting for $1.6 billion of revenue in 2017. And Laramie's proximity to mountains and trails already makes it a hub. Lindsay Olson is the owner of the outdoor gear store Atmosphere Mountain Works. She also thinks the property will encourage people to visit and stay in Laramie.
For customers, it makes sense. There's more reasons for people to jump off the interstate and come spend time here instead of just blowing through and head out to Yellowstone or Jackson or wherever they're heading to.
She says it will also incentivize new graduates to remain in Laramie.
We have a lot of students, but I'm always afraid that we're going to lose students after they graduate because, well, there's a lack of jobs maybe. But if there's these valuable recreation opportunities, maybe now in this new world, working remotely in Laramie is an opportunity.
Easy access to trails may also encourage people to try a new outdoor activity, like mountain biking. Cindy Dewan is president of BikeNet. They're a nonprofit group that built the Schoolyard Trails, a system on state land next to the proposed park.
Even before the pandemic, we had a good increase in the number of people getting into mountain biking, We've had some families where parents had no interest in mountain biking and their kids discovered it for one reason or another, and it kind of brings the whole family in, which is just super fun to see.
BikeNet is one of the many organizations that helped with planning for Pilot Hill. An incorporated group raised money from the community to buy the land, and the Wyoming Office of State Lands and Investments made the final purchase from Samuelson. Albany County will take over the management of it this fall. But Pilot Hill won't be just Samuelson's ranch. University of Wyoming and BLM-owned lands will also be a part of the area, and BikeNet plans to turn their lease on the schoolyard trails over to become a part of the parcel, too. It'll be managed by a board of directors that will oversee management of the property for Albany County. They won't just be managing for outdoor recreation. The southern half of the land will protect critical wildlife habitat and winter range for deer, elk, and pronghorn. The hope is that hunting will eventually be allowed under game and fish guidance.
It's certainly a consideration that we want to think about seriously and make sure that not only are we doing the right thing for the land and for the elk and deer herds up here, but also that we're being good stewards of the opportunity for our citizens who love to hunt and rely on that meat for their families.
Pilot Hill Trail construction will start this fall and will be completed in about a decade. After the property is officially purchased in the fall, people will be able to start enjoying it. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
Sticking with the topic of rural economies, even before the pandemic struck, rural American communities were suffering, and the blow from this new downturn could hurt even more. But a new book is optimistic that small towns can thrive if they learn to embrace the innovations of the future. I spoke with Dawn Albrick, author of Building a Resilient 21st Century Economy for Rural America. Albrick is the director of the Western Rural Development Center at Utah State University.
For decades, many rural communities have been experiencing demographic and economic decline. This is primarily a consequence of industries that rural communities have historically been dependent on, things like logging, mining. And the primary reason for this is because of improved technology. The coal mining economy, we have about one-tenth as many employees in coal mining as we had a century ago. We're producing way more coal with a much smaller workforce. And so what you have is that communities that were traditionally dependent on one of these industries has just seen fewer and fewer jobs available. As a consequence, what typically happens is that young people grow up. Like me, I grew up in one of these small towns. There was simply no jobs available. And so I went away, went to college, and have never been back. And there's thousands of people like me throughout the country that this same process has occurred. The average male is making less money now than they made in 1973 in constant dollars. And so people are working hard, but they're just not. They're not making ends meet anymore. And so, you know, just gradually over time throughout the country, you can see it in rural areas everywhere. There's just growing anger because they're working hard. They don't see any way out.
And so was Donald Trump able to fulfill his promises to try and bring back some of those rural jobs?
No. Since his election, the number of jobs in these industries, logging, mining, coal mining, oil and gas, the number of jobs has continued to go down. And the reason is because his proposed solutions don't get at the cause why we're losing these jobs in the first place. Like I mentioned, the reason that these jobs are declining is because of technology.
How have federal policies ignored rural America? Was it a certain party that has been sort of neglecting rural issues? Or is it both political parties? Can you explore that?
I think, frankly, that both parties have done nothing to benefit rural America. I think both parties have been seeking to get reelected, and where the majority of Americans live is urban areas, and so they've been shooting their policies. Frankly, I don't think they've done much of anything that's going to benefit rural America.
Yeah, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about some of the economic disadvantages that rural places have? And then also, what are the advantages of living in rural places?
The disadvantages have always been its distance. The problem is that it's just a long, long ways to where the markets and the consumers are. If you are a medical doctor, there's just fewer people, and you can't have a specialist, you can't be a heart surgeon in rural Wyoming because there's just not enough people with bad hearts. And so what I see a vast silver lining in all of this, and that is with modern information and communication technology, it is now possible for somebody to live in a rural community and market their products or market their skills globally. I think the COVID pandemic has just made this even more apparent. There are millions and millions of Americans who are working from home. Why can't this home be in rural Wyoming? Why does it have to be in Silicon Valley, California, where the job is? Or why does it have to be in New York, where the boss is, where the company is? Why can't you live in one of these beautiful Western communities and do your work over the computer like you've always done? That's the opportunity for the future, that instead of trying to refine and rebuild these industries, why not, in addition to that, instead of trying to bring back jobs that just simply aren't there, why don't we attract some of this growing number of people that have geographically mobile jobs and can, because of all the advantages and benefits, you know, it's beautiful, it's quiet, it's peaceful. You can walk out your backyard and fish or hunt.
Why should Americans care, urban Americans care, that rural America is suffering so much?
I don't think the people in New York or Denver or Salt Lake want everybody living there. They're already crowded and polluted enough. It's going to benefit urban areas as well. They have enough people already, and so why not spread some of these places out? Secondly, urban people need to recognize that their food, their energy, all of these things come from rural America, and it's got to come from places where people live, because most of our, you know, a lot of our food is still produced in rural America, and we need rural communities to support these people, and we need to make these viable, resilient, great places to live. And then I think a third reason is because they're home. I grew up in a small rural community in southern Utah. That is my home. That is where my roots are. That is where my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents are buried in the local cemetery there. I don't want this place to die. I love my hometown.
That was Don Albrick, author of Building a Resilient 21st Century Economy for Rural America. Next up, the benefits of buying an RV in a pandemic. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards. U.S. air travel is down and hotel occupancy remains low. However, one part of the tourism economy is attracting new customers, even with the pandemic. As Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, more Americans are looking to RVs and trailers to get away from home.
The first time Mark Ritchie and Leah Hardy laid eyes on their new camper, it was after they'd bought it.
It was like, oh my God, it's tiny, which was great. It made me feel actually more confident dragging it around, because when I see people with giant trailers, I go, thank God that's not me.
The three of us are standing outside their house in Laramie, Wyoming. They bought this vintage trailer from a seller in California, and then it was shipped to their doorstep. Hardy says she never thought she'd spend thousands of dollars on something sight unseen.
And that was because of COVID. Any other time, we would have driven out, looked at it before we bought it.
Instead, Hardy says they had lots of back and forth with the sellers and a few Zoom calls, too.
She would hold her iPad and, you know, can you see the toilet? Do I have it at the right angle? You know, so they were really great and really accommodating with trying to give us the most detailed tour possible of the trailer.
This specific kind of vintage trailer is called a Lil Loafer, and the outside is that silver polished aluminum. They've named it Junebug, and the name is fitting. The trailer is very cute.
Can I take a peek?
Yeah, yeah.
This is so cool. You got a little 3 gas burner, a sink.
So you have to push in that little bit. There's a toilet.
Whoa.
It's a marine toilet.
What is a marine toilet?
Like a boat would have. So it's self-contained.
It's just as charming on the inside, painted a cheery yellow color. It's functional too. There's a couch that folds out into a queen-size bed and plenty of cabinets and drawers for storage.
It's like a tortoise, right? It's bigger on the inside than the outside.
Junebug wasn't the first trailer they looked at when they started shopping for one. They say they'd find a trailer online that they liked, and then when they called the seller, it would already be sold.
Only when we started looking did we realize we were part of what I'll call the pandemic demographic of trailer buyers, because they were really selling quickly.
The price range for RVs and trailers is huge. Anywhere from around $6,000 for a pop-up to as high as $1 million for a top-of-the-line decked-out coach RV. And since the pandemic, 20% of U.S. respondents are more interested in them. That's according to an RV Industry Association survey.
It's very clear that people want to get back out there.
Monica GRC is with the association. She says RVs and other towables can essentially act as an extension of the social distance bubble you have at home.
You are able to bring your own bed, bring your own kitchen, bring your own bathroom. You have the freedom to go where you want, whether that's close to home or maybe venturing a little bit further.
And sales of this home away from home have been up in recent years. The association keeps track of the number of RVs that go from manufacturers to dealerships each year, and the last 4 years have seen record-breaking numbers. This year, January and February continued that trend. The beginning of March was looking good.
And then the pandemic hit.
The entire industry, manufacturers, dealerships, campgrounds, all shut down for weeks. As things have opened up, though, there's been a surge in buyers. And perhaps more interesting, GRC says, first-time buyers like Hardy and Richie.
We're cautiously optimistic because with this large influx of first-timers who maybe hadn't thought about RVing before, it could bring a lot of new customers to the RV industry who will fall in love with this and be RVers for life.
Richie and Hardy say they're happy with their purchase, but it has come with a bit of a learning curve.
We have been doing some parking lot, like adult parking lot, trailer driving, self-education.
Parking challenges aside, they say they're in it for the long haul. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
4th of July week is usually when professional cowboys make a lot of their income, also known as Cowboy Christmas. But most major rodeos in Wyoming, except the Cowboy Stampede, were canceled thanks to the pandemic this year. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska explains what cowboys have been doing to make ends meet.
Mid-March, right before the COVID-19 pandemic fully hit the United States, professional bullfighter Dusty Tuckness was at Rodeo Houston in Texas. He says it was going well, then it was shut down halfway through.
I remember driving home like, is this really happening? You know, is something like this going on?
Tuckness, who is originally from Meeteetse, ended up sitting at home during what is usually his busiest season.
When I got home, you know, still kind of, I guess, in shock, you know, not actually supposed to be home at that time.
During Cowboy Christmas, over the week of the 4th of July, Tuckness usually hits Cody, Casper, and then the great finale, Cheyenne Frontier Days.
You know, I have taken a hit. You know, you talk about Cody or Casper and Cheyenne and you know, 4 or 5, maybe 6 other really big rodeos that I had have canceled. So that kind of puts a dent in your pocket.
That's close to 10 major contracts that Tuckness lost. Scott Kineski with the Professional Rodeo Cowboy Association says usually there are around 25 to 35 rodeos during Cowboy Christmas.
Because of COVID, we're down to about a dozen or so. So that'll be, you know, about half the amount of rodeos that we're used to having on the 4th of July won't be going on, unfortunately.
Rodeos are slowly picking back up as states and local governments start to lift restrictions. But during the month or so that there were none, Konieski says cowboys had to rely on other means to make money.
These guys found so many different avenues to make money. We saw one guy became a tow truck driver. Another one was doing some Uber driving, or Uber Eats, actually.
When it comes to the rodeos that are continuing, it's a struggle between being financially profitable and providing good prize money for competitors. That includes Caleb Bennett. He's a professional bareback rider.
You're not seeing the numbers as far as like added purse and money out there to win. It's dang sure gonna hit the pocketbook a little bit different.
Purse money is basically the grand total paid to winners of each rodeo event and what people like Bennett really depend on. He had 4 rodeos planned for the 4th of July weekend, and 2 out of 4 were canceled.
They were spread out so far that it just doesn't make it worth it. So it's hectic.
Bennett says as rodeos are being called off, he is going to some that he hadn't even heard of before.
Instead of driving your average, say 5 to 8 hours to hit a couple rodeos from the house, we're driving 12 to, 18, 19 hours.
More time on the road means more money in the gas tank. That, plus not seeing the usual big prize money, means making far less money. That's why the Cody Stampede Rodeo still going was a big deal for Bennett and other cowboys.
And that added money over there is kind of your top end of your rodeos, especially that week. So we really look forward to that. We were tickled, to death to find out that it come back.
When Governor Mark Gordon announced that all the big Wyoming rodeos were canceled this summer, there was a lot of pushback.
There was an outcry from the town, the cowboys, and everybody, our sponsors.
That's Cody Stampede Board President Mike Darby. He says when the board sat down and tried to renegotiate added money to make it more affordable, it was about providing a place for cowboys like Bennett to compete.
It's going to be tight, and we'll settle for tight this year because in a COVID world, tight is good because there's a lot of people not really making it work these days.
Professional bareback rider Caleb Bennett says he's thankful the show went on in Cody, but he says he's crossing his fingers for rodeo's future.
I believe it's going to take, a couple years to really come back and be in full force again, but I do think it'll come back.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Open Spaces. If you're worried you missed an episode, no problem. Just sign up for our podcast at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.